I call the Agriculture, Finance, and Policy Committee meeting to order on February 20, 2024. We have two presentations today. It'll be an informational hearing. So first off will be the Office of Broadband, Executive Director Bree Mackey, and I believe Daryl Dannon from Deed is present to present before the committee today. All right, if you can introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon. My name is Bree Mackey for the record and the Executive Director at the Office of Broadband Development.
And hello, my name is Darielle Dannon. I am the Government Relations Director at DEED.
All right, with that, I'll start our presentation. And as always, I want this to be a learning opportunity. So if you have questions during the presentation, feel free to ask. Otherwise, happy to take them at the end as well. So, and Darielle will be helping me with the slides. So thank you once again for having me here to share the incredible work that our office has done over the past year. And we'll just get into it. So, as a reminder, the Office of Broadband Policy Framework is as such. We do have statutory goals, so remember the 100 by 20 by 2026 is our next sort of goal that we're going after here. We do have the Office of Broadband, and we do have the Governor's Task Force on Broadband, of both which our office does also support the task force. We have our mapping program and all of our data, which has been something that the office has done since 2028, before even established, but as a state. And that is all available on our website. And those maps do get updated twice a year. And then finally, we have a lot of tools in our tool belt as far as infrastructure grant programs and now our digital equity work. So here's the team. For those of you who have been around broadband for a long time, you probably remember there was maybe one or two or maybe three. With all of the additional resources, both federally and state, we have been able to grow our team. And what I do like most about this slide is the fact that you can see by those dots, those are the geographical locations of which members of my team are located. So they live and work in communities across the state and really understand the work that we're doing and the impact we're doing. And I'll just put a quick plug. Mine is down in Southeast Winona County. So, woohoo. All right. So why are we still here? We've been doing this a long time. So as I mentioned, our maps are updated in November as well as in the spring, but these most recent maps were of November 2023. I did also show that last year in 2022, just so that you can understand how are we doing. So I do really believe these numbers of access are going down because of the hard work of all of you and the hard work of our providers and the communities across the state. But we still know there's a great need. And those are also the most expensive and hardest places to serve. And so just be understanding of that. So I know the map is small, but you can see sort of where are the locations in Minnesota that are still not getting that speed of our speed goals of 100 by 20. Oh, yes, it's very hard to see on there. So the red is still the unserved areas that do not have the 25.3. And then it goes into the green, I believe, of the 100 by 20, and then the other areas are served. All right, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I'll be talking about a lot of this during the rest of my presentation, but I do want to highlight a few things in here. So our annual report is posted online every year, and so I would encourage you to take some time and just even review some of the highlights because these are just a few of them. But I do want to at least highlight that the Office of Broadband does take phone calls, and we do phone calls from residents and businesses across the state at any time and help them understand what providers they have available, if they're unserved, if they should connect with a provider, if they should apply for line extension program, all those things. So customer service is really a part of the work we do every day. The other thing I just want to touch base on is that we are actively working with our tribal communities and are doing consultations with them as much as we are able to as well. I think I'll leave it at that. All right, so as a reminder, last year's legislative session was another historic movement for Office of Broadband and the work you all have done with $100 million in the biennial. So thank you again for all of your support and the work that you have done to continue to move our goals forward. With that, each year is $50 million, and of that, directed to do $30 million in our border-to-border, our traditional grant program, and $20 million in the low population program. The only technical change that was made was from $5 million to $10 million on a maximum grant. All right, so this slide is really good as a reflection to where we have been. And I really want you also to focus. Sometimes we see numbers, we see match dollars, but what is really great about it is looking at the number of locations that have been served through the last grant rounds that we have done. And that's over 100,000 folks, businesses, individuals, homes across the state that we have been able to get broadband access to. So really a huge impact. And then also knowing, not including this additional $100 million, we have awarded over $237 million in grants over the course of those years. All right, so where are we now? We currently are going through and ranking and making ready to award grant round 9. And so again, that's $50 million, of which $30 million will be in border to border, and $20 million in low population. What I can tell you is that we did receive 38 applications in our traditional border to border for over $65 million. And again, we have $30 million available. With our low population program, we had 31 applicants and over $85 million in applications. So again, oversubscribed greatly. Grant round 10. So we have that $50 million that we hope to launch soon after we make the grant round 9 awards. One of the reasons is because with the BEAD dollars, the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, which I will share a little more and you're probably all familiar with, we really need to know what dollars, spend all our dollars and know the final locations we need to serve with the federal dollars. In order to do that, we need to spend all of our state dollars. So we're hoping to make official awards on those applications soon after the July 1st, so we'll be in the next biennium as directed by the legislature. All right, the line extension program. So during the 2022 legislative session, we were able to create the Line Extension Connection Program. And really, this awards grants to extend the existing broadband infrastructure to the actual home. So often you see that maybe where I live, the line goes across the street, didn't actually come to my home. And this really helps to bridge the barrier of getting that deployment and the cost to access up to the door. And we did use capital projects dollars on that, and we have $15 million available. These line extension applications are self-applied, so residents and businesses can self go on the website and register for the program. So we did make one award so far, and we're in the process of finalizing the next round of winning bids, per se. And with that first round, we had over 2,356 addresses in our portal. And with that, over $4.3 million in awards were made. And the average, I think some really good data for all of you to be aware of, is the average cost per those locations was almost $9,000. So we're seeing that cost a little more, and that is an average. So there were some that were more and some that were less. I think it's also really important to note that our providers are matching dollars. This isn't 100%. They are also contributing to the cost to make sure that these deployments happen, and it has been a really great partnership. So of those, we were able to award 843 homes and businesses, and we already have, I believe, 3 that are close to completion, which doesn't sound like a lot, but that is directly getting broadband to people's homes. Funding rounds will continue until those dollar amounts are exhausted, and we, again, hope to have the next round coming very soon. All right, we'll move into the federal dollars, and as a reminder, with the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, Internet for All was created, and the Office of Broadband and other states and territories, each state, are getting a certain dollar amount to help deploy broadband to all the unserved locations and get internet for all. There are two programs. One is the BEAD program, again, the Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, so the infrastructure program. And then there's also the digital equity funding. Our dollar amount in this, and you can go to the next slide, was based on a formula, and those formulas were based on the FCC maps at the time that the formulas were directed. We do know that those maps are not 100%, and so I will just share a little bit more in a few minutes, but just remember that we will work on getting those maps as correct and as accurate as we can. So back to the BEAD itself, so $652 million about, and we are directed to use that on three, well, there's actually more priorities, but in Minnesota, we have three priorities we're really focusing on because of the dollar amount. One is our priority. One is to get to all unserved locations, and by definition from NTIA, that is 25 by 3. After we can show that we can get to all those locations, then we can move on to the underserved, which is the 100 and by 20, and then from there we can go into community anchor institutions. Again, I talked a little bit about the federal FCC map. So on this slide, the red areas are areas that they have indicated that they would be under priority one or the 25-3 and would need to be served. And again, then with the next, the orange locations are the underserved, and the green would be areas that already have reliable internet. Obviously, there's pockets when you zoom into the slide. It's more granular and more detailed, but just to sort of give you a snapshot of where Minnesota is as a whole. The Office of Broadband, we have holistically defined, historically defined our broadband as wire service, though we are technology agnostic. But with NTIA's dollars, it's either wired service or licensed fixed wireless. So still working on some of those in partnership with NTIA on how that defines. And then the last and really important thing that I want to flag on the screen is the challenge process. So once our volume one is approved, and we had two volumes, they've both been submitted. This is the initial plan. We can go into a challenge process, and what that allows us to do is capture all the locations that are still unserved or are already served or could be a shed in the middle of the field that will never need to be served, so should be taken off the map. So it's our opportunity as a state to really finalize those maps to have a snap in time. The only people or organizations that can challenge during this process is our internet service providers, nonprofits, and local units of government. So an individual can't necessarily do a challenge. They can do a challenge, but then it goes in under the blanket of all of those locations or all of those organizations. So we've been trying to have conversations with our associations, really narrow down how we get the word out. Speed checks are going to be a little complicated for folks because not everybody is going to be able to do the three speed checks at the same time to make sure that they have challenged that location. So the partnerships that we are working on with the nonprofits, ISPs, and local units of government will be really important to make sure we're capturing all the unserved locations. And again, taking off those that will not be served, keeping in mind there is no additional funds available for more locations. We still have to stay within the confines of the dollar amount we receive from the federal dollars. Yeah. Some of the things that we have identified as far as challenges to deployment with BEAD are as follows, and the one that probably when I'm talking to colleagues across the nation that gets them a lot of time is weather. Now, this year may not have been as much of an issue, but really, we do have less time throughout the year to deploy infrastructure in Minnesota. We are certainly concerned about workload or workforce, supply chains, accuracy of the map. Remember, every state and territory will be in charge of deploying this at the same time. And so that's going to be a big thing for everybody to work through. And so some of the concerns that we have here. As far as timeline on the BEAD program, as I shared, our initial proposal was sent in December. We're working right now with NTIA of what I like to respectfully call a negotiation process. So they review our plan, come back, give us suggestions, go back and forth. Some of the things within the scope of the work within the plan are because of statutory language that I respect from the state here. And so we need some additional guidance. So working back and forth, also recognizing that this is Minnesota's plan and how to make sure that we are doing it in the most effective way that we can in Minnesota. The challenge process, I would say this was an aggressive schedule when created. The challenge process will take up to 120 days, and we have not launched that yet. So it may get pushed because we can't start that till our volume one is all approved by NTIA. So I would say maybe closer to the April date. There'll be a 30-day challenge period. There'll be a 30-day challenge from the providers to say yes, no. And then we have up to 90 days as the state office to deduplicate, go through, and really finalize that snap in time and what those final maps will look like. Once that's all done and our volume two is approved, then we have 365 days to finalize our final proposal, which includes all of our subgrantee selection. So I won't go through all of these slides, but just know that potentially we're not looking to start deployment until maybe 2025, early 2026, depending on when everything is approved. All right, with that, I'm just going to touch base a little bit on the Digital Equity Act. As a reminder, the state of Minnesota received $881,000 to do our plan. And so we did our plan over the past year. It was submitted, and now we are also in negotiations with NTIA to finalize that plan. And so there's a lot of unknowns with this right now, but we really are proud of the work that we did in this space and think that this plan that we created really does mirror what Minnesota would like to see. And with that, I'll just touch base. What we created were digital connection committees across the state. These were self-guided committees. They would be nonprofits, faith groups, local units of government, libraries, immigrant populations, that really were charged with assessing what they had in their communities, what are their barriers, and also what are things that would be very well mimicked and could be used across the state. And so really proud that we were able to create this capacity throughout the state. Those dots are just listening sessions. So we did 18 listening sessions as a small office across the state to get out and hear. And once we had all that information, we then put that into our digital opportunity plan. We didn't write a plan and then go in and make tweaks on it. We listened to what people and community said and adapted that into a plan that we think is really meaningful for the state. Just a couple things. Our vision statement really encompasses wrapping ourselves around that people want to be connected to each other. People want to be connected to opportunities, and people really want to be connected to options. And so that's where we heard from folks and sort of, again, where we're moving forward and hopefully a plan that is meaningful and useful to the state. All right, so in this plan, and if you read the plan, it is available on our website, is we tried to come with examples of how once we get through the planning process and we receive our federal dollars for capacity, what do those capacity grants look like? So some of the things that came up were creating digital opportunity leaders networks. They could be curriculum and administering different grants for jobs in the repair technician world or technical support. It could also be formula grants for states and counties, because we know one barrier to access and to do this work is small communities don't always have that. So could we create some sort of block grant or capacity grants that were less competitive? And then also looking at ways that we can help reduce the cost of internet for low cost or for low income homes. So these are just examples. There's tons more online. What do we know now? Well, I don't know much right now. I hate to say it, except for our plan we're working on finalizing. And again, this is a robust plan. The team has worked really hard, and it's a really thoughtful plan. So going back and forth a little bit with NTIA to approve that. We do not know what our capacity dollar grants will be. We do not know when the notice of funding will be coming. I was at a conference last week where it was announced that the first state did get their plan approved, which was the state of Maine. My understanding by law, the NOFO has to be issued within 30 days. So we're hopeful we'll have some information soon. And finally, I have to just mention ACP program. We all have probably heard how important this is to the state of Minnesota. We currently have over 238 folks using it of an eligibility of over almost 800,000 homes. All of this work is incredible and is necessary, but being able to access it and afford it is equally as important. So just want to put a plug in for that as well. Though this is a federal program, it will impact members of our communities. Oh, yeah. For those of you who are not aware, the Affordable Connectivity Plan provides a $30 voucher to homes. It goes, the internet service providers do it. The office doesn't do it. It's a federal program up to $75. To support internet access in homes for our tribal communities. Yeah, it's a per month. Sorry. I got a little bird in my ear here. Sorry. Yes, it is a per month. And with that, I am certainly open to any questions. One thing I just want to mention is on March 12th at the Heritage Center here in the metro area, we will be celebrating 10 years of connecting One Minnesota to broadband, and would encourage anybody to participate and share. It is a day to celebrate and reflect the work that has been done by many of you and many people before me. So I encourage you to pass that along too. But open for questions.
Thank you, Executive Director Bree. Members, question. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And an impressive amount of money both at the state and federal level. My question relates to often with federal money or even with state money, when we're building something, there are prevailing wage requirements. I'm just checking, are there prevailing wage requirements for installation of broadband?
Executive Director?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, so within our BEAD plan, we did include, which was part of our scoring rubric, fair labor. As far as my understanding of broadband itself, the federal BEAD program does not require it. It is encouraged. Each state can do it. Broadband itself, prevailing wage only at this point in the state is when middle mile is involved. Otherwise, we have otherwise been exempt at the state level. As of right now, within the federal plans, again, it isn't a requirement. It is something that they would like us to look at, and we did utilize safety training and fair labor within the rubric of scoring any of our sub-grantees.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so in the plan, we did not put that Minnesota could require prevailing wage.
Mm-mm. Executive Director.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. At the, no, it is not it is not written in the plan as such.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then final question. So when people are installing broadband, are there, what's the background? Are they usually covered by a bargaining unit, or is it just kind of an open call for people hiring? And as part of that, when there's installation occurring, is there records kept of if, let's say, there are other lines being hit or, you know, other electrical lines or gas lines or anything? Is there any record of incidents that are kept for during these installations if there are impacts by the broadband installation?
Executive Director?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So I think just to answer your question, so first, we are not regular. We work with our state partners when it comes to making sure that our providers and the consultants that they use and the teams that they use to do the install have the information. So certainly, you know, try to be a connector when there are questions. But it does vary a little bit. We do have smaller providers across the state that may be unionized, may not be unionized, have insourced labor, and others that do not. When it comes to some of the big projects, you know, they're generally not state funded if they're already served. So in most cases, that's not something that we are regulating. But if they would be in violation or something would come up that is of concern, we definitely in the next funding round would take that into consideration and would be on our purview.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. You could further explain a little bit on the line extension program. You mentioned that if the line was being plowed in across the street, this program could help get it up to a person's house. But as I recall, out in my rural area, the phone company went around and asked each homeowner if they wanted service, and then they plowed it right up to the edge of the house and connected you in. So how close did a main line have to be before they would automatically go and connect a home without having to utilize this program?
Executive Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So it varies a little bit. So sometimes when a line extension is necessary, it may have been a previous homeowner chose not to be connected at the time that it was passed. Other times it may just be because at the time they were further along. So maybe they're a mile away from that connection or 2 mile, and that was a cost to the landowner to get it there that was just a barrier that they couldn't afford. Or couldn't make do at that time. So it varies a little bit. Certainly when we get applications or bids from our provider, if it looks like a border-to-border application versus a line extension, you know, a clump of whatever it is, then we certainly want to have conversations with the provider because really this is to pick up those areas that have been left behind or just too far to make the cost model.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. Then one last question. If you could give me just a ballpark number. We all know what's happened to inflation the last 5 or 10 years. Do you have any kind of a figure that would tell us what inflation has done to the cost of laying in fiber cable 5 years ago compared to today or 10 years ago? What has inflation done to the cost?
Executive Director.
Madam Chair, Representative, that is a really great question. I will tell you right now, we do have an RFP out for a cost data analysis for this very reason, because we do know that the dollars that we are receiving both federally and at the state level, there are concerns of meeting our statutory goals and getting to everybody. And so with this RFP and hopefully extensive review, we'll have some solid numbers for you before the end of the session.
Representative Anderson. Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Vang. So you just briefly grazed across the words licensed fixed wireless services. So is this program providing funding for wireless services?
Executive Director.
Madam Chair, Representative Jacobs. So again, the office is agnostic when it comes to technology. We also know that historically, wired service has not been at the state level fully served. But with NTIAs, with the BEAD dollars, licensed fixed wireless is reliable broadband service by definition. And so we also know that it's going to take probably all technology to get to all the unserved locations. So we're going to have to really rely on our providers working with us to, and our communities, what service do they want and need and the best investment to get to all the unserved locations and still stay within those dollar thresholds that require me to be able to do so. So unfortunately, I don't have a good answer at this point because it might be satellite in some locations if I can't get a provider to go there financially with incentives or within the parameter of the rules that we are having to abide by.
Representative Jacob?
Yeah, well, as a follow-up, so in my district, obviously, really rugged terrain, and so it could be tower-to-tower, could be satellite, but the need is certainly there. So you're saying that potentially that's a possibility if a wire can't get there.
Executive Director?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jacobs, yes, and as a person in your district that is on wireless and have to go out and cut corn tassels off when my line of sight is not there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we certainly want to make sure we are making long-term investments that are meaningful, that are buildable, and we can build off of for many years. So, yes, these are all of concern to the office as we are looking forward in our plan.
Thank you.
Representative Sinsamira.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is kind of following up on something that you spoke of before, which is when you're installing and other lines get hit. I'm wondering if do you all keep track of that, and can you speak a little bit to the process around that? Thank you.
Executive Director.
Madam Chair, thank you, Representative, for the question. That is not something that we track and are usually never, we're not made aware of. We're not the regulatory agency on there. Again, most of our providers, I mean, with grant dollars, they are in the communities and they want the utmost safety for their neighbors that they're serving. And so I don't track that information. It would only be hearsay.
Representative Sinsamira. Representative Cha.
I was kind of curious about the delivery of promised broadband, right? So sometimes we promise 100 and then we probably don't get that. Who oversees that, and do you actually have numbers on failed delivery of services?
Executive Director.
Madam Chair, Representative. So that is also, we are not the regulatory agency on there, and so it is not something that, you know, we have jurisdiction over. However, our maps online, we do have a modular to do speed tests, and we certainly work with landowners, residents, to make sure they know what speeds are available and by who when we can provide that technical assistance. One thing I will just say as we're negotiating with the BEAD dollars that I did ask NTIA to consider was the burden of proof be on the provider and not on the resident. And so I'm not sure where that would land, but we are trying really hard because we know that the speed tests that are required to challenge are cumbersome and often confusing for our residents.
Representative Cha?
Do you know what state agency is responsible for that?
Executive Director?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative, I apologize. Commerce would be in charge of that.
Representative Cha?
Thank you. I just have a small question. For the border grants and the low population density grants, I'm just question of what types of providers are applying for these? Are they generally large or small providers?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and really great question. So in Minnesota, we're really fortunate because we have all types of providers. We have our rural electric cooperatives that are serving their members that may otherwise not have service. We have our traditional internet service providers. We have our small telcos that once did our telephone service and stepped up because their members needed broadband. As we talked about, there are also satellite providers as well as other wireless providers. So in Minnesota, we do really have options somewhat as far as who we are able to work with and what those internet providers look like. There's also could be municipalities as well.
Any further questions from members? Vice Chair Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Mackey. I believe we can get the presentation sent to us, but is there a website or someplace where those maps are more interactive so we can look at the fine detail and zoom in and look at the granular? Thank you.
Executive Director.
Yes, so thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Yes, our website does have a pretty user-friendly map area. If I can use it, most people can. Little do you all know, I'm not as techie as I may appear in this role. But yes, it is very user-friendly. And as I said earlier, my team is always happy to get on the phone with any resident and walk through those maps and really identify and we do that with the line extension. Every applicant we go through, and we go through a process of reviewing, do they have service, who do they have service with, where could they get service, and connecting folks if it's available. If not, then obviously it moves into the bidding process within the line extension. But the maps are pretty user-friendly. Yeah. Yeah, the website is on there, and then the map, it just says maps and data behind that. So. But happy to send it out, and yes, the slides will be made available.
Vice Chair Purcell? Yeah, and the presentation are posted on the committee webpage. Okay, seeing no further questions, thank you so much for being here today, and looking forward to working together. Next we have is the Board of Animal Health. And while as they make their way down here, I think we have a quorum present. So, Vice Chair, have you reviewed the minutes? May I have a motion to approve the minutes from February
15, 2024? So moved, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Purcell moves the approval of the minutes for February 15, 2024. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 15, 2024 are approved. So with the Board of Animal Health members, the presentation is in your handout, or they have a handout here. Please state your name for the record. I believe we have a new executive director. And welcome to the committee. Pleasure to have both of you here, and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Vang. My name is Dr. Brian Hafes. I'm the Minnesota State Veterinarian and Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Animal Health.
Yes, thank you. And I'm Michelle Medina. I serve as Director of Human Relations for the Department of Ag and the Board of Animal Health.
Just a further introduction of myself. Prior to serving as or being appointed as the State Veterinarian and Executive Director for the Board of Animal Health, just this past August, I served in the role of interim from April till August. And prior to that, I was a senior veterinarian with the Board of Animal Health, overseeing swine programs, equine programs, biologics, and livestock concentration points. Prior to that, I worked in several forms of veterinary private practice, from companion animals to mixed animals to equine, as well as some poultry companies. And I also spent 12 years in academia training veterinary technicians. Mission statement for the Board of Animal Health is to protect the health of the state's domestic animals through education and cooperation with veterinarians, producers, owners, and communities. Our agency is guided by a board of directors. Last legislative session actually voted in an additional board member, so we are currently at seven board members. The change to the population included a companion animals-focused veterinarian, so we're happy to have Dr. Abigail Maynard join us last fall in that capacity. Moving on to programs at the board, probably our most recognizable activity to date is the highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreak that we've been dealing with since early last October. This incidence, knock on wood, has subsided for the time being. Our last reported case was on January 10th. We continue to do surveillance and test suspect flocks. We get calls occasionally from both backyard flock owners and commercial flock owners. Currently, we're in the process of demobilizing our incident. So demobilization means that we are inviting the friends that joined us on this response, so the Department of Agriculture, United States Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, the partner agencies that have helped us with the response are able to demobilize, and the Board of Animal Health is kind of wrapping up the response until the anticipated spring wave. So we are fully aware that the migratory season is is upon us, and likely we will see another onslaught of highly pathogenic avian influenza. There is some optimism. We did not have the surge last spring that we did in 2022. No real information to share why that was the case. We chalk it up to strange weather patterns and strange migratory patterns. So, as we all know, this winter has been strange as anything we've seen lately. So possibly our migratory patterns will be different as well. The total cost from October through the end of the year for the response was roughly $450,000 in Board of Animal Health staff time. This slide is just kind of an overview update of the cases that we had in this fall to winter episode. We had a total of 39 cases. 23 of those were in commercial turkey meat bird premises. 10 were commercial turkey breeder facilities, 1 commercial table egg layer, and 5 backyard premises. The next disease of interest to us is fairly hot off the presses. Avian metapneumovirus was recently discovered out on the southeast coast. Avian metapneumovirus isn't a new disease per se in Minnesota. We actually had dealt with an outbreak of this in the late 90s to early 2000s. The curious thing about the current outbreak is it's a different subtype. So we dealt with subtype C previously in Minnesota and across the country. We're able to eradicate it through surveillance and vaccination. Subtype B is actually a subtype that has never been seen in the United States before. So that complicates things a little bit from the standpoint of surveillance and detection. We have detection capabilities for subtype C and are working with our partners at the Minnesota Poultry Testing Lab to develop testing capabilities for subtype B and an additional subtype A that was found out in California. So currently we're monitoring the national situation. We're not currently believing there is avian metapneumovirus in Minnesota. However, we recognize the importance of monitoring for that and doing surveillance. I want to bring these two diseases together and kind of illustrate the complications they provide for us. So I think we can all agree that it's sometimes hard to tell the difference between a sinus infection and the flu. And that's kind of what we're dealing with here. Influenza is a respiratory disease. Avian metapneumovirus also presents as a respiratory disease, specifically infecting the sinus cavity. So we're dealing with two diseases with very similar symptoms, and it requires additional surveillance, additional testing, additional oversight. Swine programs. Our primary focus with our swine programs is managing and preparing for African swine fever. African swine fever has never been in North America, but we are constantly concerned about its present worldwide. The closest African swine fever is right now is in the Caribbean. The Dominican Republic and Haiti are currently dealing with a situation. We have extra parameters in place for our territories in Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands, but we also recognize its movement in some of the Western European countries as well. Late last summer, early fall, Sweden was diagnosed with African swine fever. These become important because those are trade partners; those are countries that we do export and sometimes import swine from. Currently, Minnesota partners with several agencies as well as industry to prepare for this disease. This isn't a Minnesota exclusive thing. The United States Department of Agriculture has guidance in place for a response, and then each state is charged with developing their own state-specific plan. So we've worked very closely with Department of Agriculture, USDA, swine veterinarians, and swine producers in Minnesota to come up with a plan that fits our location, the second largest swine producing state in the country. In addition to our preparation plans, we're also on surveillance for feral swine. There's a curious connection with feral swine and African swine fever. The magic combination for African swine fever to get into a country has been feeding untreated swill or garbage feeding in conjunction with a feral swine population. Typically, feral swine are the first population to succumb to the virus, and from there it gets spread to our domestic species. So over the last year, we heard a lot of reports from Canada about some super pigs, as they were coined, that were very resilient in the northern climate. We had not expected feral swine to be an issue in Minnesota because of our northern climate, but our neighbors to the north have warned us otherwise. I was at the Minnesota Pork Congress last week visiting with our counterparts from Canada and actually got a little different report, a little more optimistic report. Previously, we were told Canada's problem was insurmountable and they were basically working on containment but doubted they could eradicate the problem. The reports we're getting now is it's a nuisance. It's certainly a concern, but they feel they will be able to eradicate their feral swine population within 10 years. That doesn't decrease our vigilance. We certainly recognize the proximity of Canada to our northern border. The maps certainly indicate that there have been sightings of loose pigs along the northern border of Minnesota. Again, our Canadian counterparts have reported that those have not been substantiated, and they're finding a lot of those reports may be attributable to actually bear cubs and even raccoons. People have determined were misidentified as feral pigs. This also leads to a report that we worked on with the DNR regarding feral swine detection and surveillance in Minnesota. And I believe that report is being presented next week by the DNR, if I'm not mistaken. So my point there is it's a group effort. We work together on these disease surveillances and how to mitigate the threat. Next program I wanted to talk about is our companion animal program. We had a few disease occurrences this last year. The first one was a canine influenza outbreak in the summer of 23. This outbreak stemmed from some animal shelters that had transported infected dogs from our southern states and brought the virus back with them. Dr. Barsh at the Board of Animal Health and her team was instrumental in identifying that infection and instituting measures to control it. So we worked very closely with the animal shelter that first had a case diagnosed to identify how to control the spread, how to quarantine those animals to allow them to recover. In addition, we worked quickly to educate clinics, dog owners, and businesses how to prevent the disease and how to keep your dogs healthy. Our slogan basically was vaccinate your dog. So canine influenza has a successful vaccine available. So just a reminder to keep your animals healthy, keep them vaccinated. Second respiratory disease that made headlines in late 2023 was atypical canine infectious respiratory disease, sometimes referred to as a mystery dog illness. This disease really didn't make an appearance in Minnesota. We certainly were on the lookout. We heard about this disease kind of on opposing coasts. So initially it was diagnosed or reported on the West Coast, and then we started hearing more reports on the East Coast. I often get questions about what causes this mystery dog illness, and the answer's in the name. It's a mystery. So that's a little bit facetious. The mystery is which component is causing your dog's disease. So we recognize there's a variety of infectious agents that actually can cause this illness. It can be viral, it can be bacterial, protozoal, fungal. Similar to human respiratory disease, sometimes we don't know the cause, we just know the symptoms are very similar. There isn't a widespread surveillance system in place for canine infectious respiratory disease because of the agents that it possibly could be. So multiple agents, it's hard to have a surveillance protocol in place to determine which one might be here. We do see an increasing trend in canine respiratory diseases. So these are just two examples. Some of that is attributable to the amount of movement our companion animals are doing these days. It's not uncommon for people to travel and vacation with their pets. So as we know with people, when you bring animals to a location that they're not used to, they're going to pick up the local flora and a lot of times develop some mild to moderate illness because of that. So again, we continue to do surveillance for this disease. I also wanted to highlight kind of the response again with Dr. Barsh and her team and the collaboration we had with the University of Minnesota. When these reports were first coming out, Dr. Barsh was able to reach out to the University of Minnesota to ask for incident report on cases they may have seen. Really, there were no cases to report. And in addition to that, the diagnostic lab reached out to her to ask what they can do to help with surveillance. So just wanted to illustrate again the partnership we enjoy with our diagnostic lab and the University of Minnesota. Rabies has been a hot topic this year in Minnesota as well. So the rabies season has been a little obscure. Typically we see a spike or a introduction of our rabies season in late August, September. This year we actually started seeing cases in June and July. So an earlier onset of cases, and they lagged well into December. The rabies that we see in Minnesota are generally from bat or skunk variety. Majority of the positive cases that are reported are actually from bats that are captured. We had a couple of unique cases that are worth mentioning. We actually had a couple of calves that tested positive in the same county in Minnesota. The strange thing was they weren't neighbors. They weren't located nearby. We were able to trace those calves back to a single origin place, however, through a livestock market in South Dakota. So just to illustrate our partnership with our counterparts in South Dakota, they were able to trace these animals actually came from the same farm, and we did some genomic testing on the brains of both calves to determine they were actually bitten by the same skunk. So amazing where modern technology has gotten us. Another unique case that I wanted to point out, and there's a picture on the right of a rather cantankerous fisher. So a weasel family member that tested positive for rabies. I wish I could show you the video of this. This is an interesting case because the individual who was attacked actually pulled out her phone and took a video. This is a still shot from that video. So she was leaving her daughter's house to go home late one night, and something attacked her. She ran back in the house, turned on the lights, and this is what she saw. This fisher was still trying to get to her through the patio door. Fishers are a protected species in Minnesota, so the DNR was called out to dispatch the animal, and the brain was submitted to the Minnesota Department of Health Diagnostic Lab and determined to be positive for rabies. Anthrax was a disease we dealt with midsummer in Minnesota. Anthrax is not a foreign disease in Minnesota, but we consider it a reportable disease. Anthrax is a naturally occurring spore-forming bacteria found in some soils. This is something that we tend to see resurface in times of flood and then drought. So you can imagine how things are brought to the surface during a flood, and then as things dry out, those spores are allowed to stay on the surface. We don't consider this a risk to the public, to humans. This is more a risk of animals that are grazing close to the ground and in close proximity to inhale those spores. Farm cervids. The news with our farm cervid program is the transfer of authority from the Board of Animal Health to the DNR of farmed white-tailed deer. Board of Animal Health still maintains jurisdiction over all other cervids, and then mixed herds we share responsibility with the DNR. And I wanted to point out the last chronic wasting disease detection in a farmed cervid was October 2022. And this is my last slide, again, to remind me to share with you the collaborations we enjoy and make sure I touched on them earlier. The first list there is in reference to those partners in our high pathogenic avian influenza outbreak. The Minnesota Department of Agriculture, UNIS Department of Agriculture, Minnesota Department of Health, and University of Minnesota are in lockstep with the Board of Animal Health when we have a disease outbreak of that magnitude. The Board of Animal Health is a small agency, and we enjoy our partnership with those agencies listed to help us accomplish what we were able to accomplish. Additionally, the Board of Animal Health has been working collaboratively with the DNR to navigate the oversight of that transfer of white-tailed deer, farmed white-tailed deer to the Department of Natural Resources, as well as collaboration on the feral swine and mink report that I mentioned earlier. And I also wanted to refer you to the handouts that we provided. There's some additional information there that gives you numbers and figures of some of the disease events that I presented so far. And with that, I will take any questions.
All right. Questions from the committee? Representative Shaw.
Hi, welcome to the Ag Committee. I have a question in regards to the proposal of the Companion Animal Board. I'd like to hear your opinion on it. Do we need one or, in the state of Minnesota?
Executive Director.
Chair Vang, Representative. I think the Board of Animal Health does an excellent job in overseeing companion animal programs in the state of Minnesota. We are very fortunate with the staff that we have that works in our companion animal program. They've been very instrumental in identifying these diseases that we've been presented with and stamping them out. The addition of Dr. Maynard to the Board of Directors only further strengthens that. I think the Board of Animal Health has the companion animal program in hand.
Representative Cha?
Yes, and then my second question is, can you talk more about the impact of PFAS on animal welfare in the state of Minnesota? Or is there a study or?
Executive Director?
Chair Vang, Representative. Currently, the Board of Animal Health is not directly involved in that. I will say there is a nationwide research into PFAS and contamination. I was at a convention this fall, and my constituents from Indiana reported some really interesting findings. They had at slaughter a dairy cow that had been culled and went to slaughter had been tested by USDA Food Inspection Services to have PFAS contamination. It was an interesting traceability concern because they could not figure out where it came from. In the end, they determined that it was actually due to paper mill waste that had been spread on a field that raised crops that these dairy cattle were feeding on. So while the Board of Animal Health isn't currently involved in any research, we certainly are aware that that is a concern, and we're poised to be a part of that research and part of that response.
Representative Cha?
Thank you for your comments.
Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of questions on rabies, and I would agree that rabies can be kind of a scary thing. I had a dog that got tangled up with a skunk a couple years ago, and the skunk turned out to be positive and had to quarantine the dog. And that was a USDA vet that came out, I think, to my farm and made sure that quarantine took place. But I see on your stats here, you're talking about a significant increase from the previous years in rabies cases. Can you attribute that to any one or two reasons why we're seeing more rabies now?
Is that a director?
Chair Vang, Representative, I'd be speculating. I have theories on that. I would suggest that the season has been longer, and I'm going to offer maybe it has to do with warmer climates. People are able to do more construction, more things in their homes that kind of cause bats to be in circulation when they normally wouldn't. It seems that the August-September timeframe is when bats are seen because they're kind of going into hibernation. I think people were just more active and able to come into contact with them. Exact numbers I don't have, but the Minnesota Department of Health would be able to give the exact numbers. I believe they reported about a 100% increase from last year, so double the cases of rabies as were reported last year.
Representative Anderson.
So would that be increase in cases of animals getting it or people getting rabies from animals? What do you mean by cases?
Executive Director.
Chair Vang, Representative, those would be animal cases. So I don't have stats on human cases. I don't believe there have been any human cases in the last year. Certainly those are devastating.
Yeah.
Those would be animal cases. And it's a mix of positive bats, skunks, and domestic animals.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. So just to follow up, you mentioned or showed that picture of the fissure that was infected. And you mentioned that that's a protected animal and somebody had to come out and dispose of the animal. But, you know, if my wife was faced with an animal like that, I think I'd go get my gun myself and not take a chance of letting that thing walk off and scare somebody else. So is a person not supposed to take care of a situation like that, or do you have to wait for somebody else to come out, DNR, to take care of it?
Executive Director.
Chair Vang, Representative, I think that would be a question for the DNR. The Board of ML Health is not going to get in your way or your wife's way. One important thing we need to mention, though, is how to dispatch the animal is very important. So testing for rabies has to be on brain tissue. And unfortunately, a lot of people assume the best place to shoot a potentially rabid animal is in the head, and that causes unsatisfactory sample to result. So we aren't able to test those. So part of the reason why we include the DNR, they're responsible for those restricted species, but they also recognize that part of the diagnostic procedure.
Representative Anderson. Representative Sensimera.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. My question is around something that I've heard about from constituents. It's like the lack of veterinarians in the state, or the shortage of veterinarians. Can you speak to, are you seeing that? Are you seeing that in kind of certain sectors with large animals or with livestock animals at county fairs? And how is your agency approaching that? Thank you.
Executive Director.
Chair Vang, Representative. That's certainly something we're acutely aware of. It's not within our purview to have a lot of influence over that. However, we do have some ability to assist with that. So definitely the production animal, livestock, food animal, large animal veterinarians are the ones that are dwindling in supply. There's nationwide research on this suggesting that there's a shortage in all sectors, but likely it's focused on those production animal, large animal species. It's a complicated problem. Some of it is lack of resources. Some of it is lack of funding for the veterinarians that would serve those areas. So where the Board of Animal Health is involved is we get to help determine what areas are lacking in those types of veterinarians and propose those areas as areas of need to federal folks when they're talking about loan forgiveness programs. And so identifying the areas in the state that are in need of more veterinarians. We certainly recognize it also from the regulatory side of things. So our agency is lucky. We've got a full group of veterinarians that are very capable, but it hasn't always been that way. I say we were lucky. I talked to counterparts in other states, and they have a difficult time finding veterinarians to serve in that capacity. Our partners at the USDA have struggled with that as well. So I would chalk those all up to food animal production, food safety veterinarians as being a shortage area that we are concerned with, and we do our part to identify those and report back to entities that are able to provide loan forgiveness for veterinarians going into that type of practice.
Representative Samara, any further questions? All right, members, it seems like we may end committee early. You want to stay longer, Representative Nelson? Well, thank you so much, Executive Director and Michelle, Director Michelle, for being here. And I don't think I've expressed congratulations to your new role. So we're happy to have you here and looking forward to working together.
Thank you.
And with that, members, our next meeting is Thursday, February 22, 2024, and this meeting is adjourned.